welcome to This Bloody Business. I'm your host, indie filmmaker Andrew Johnson Schmidt. Each episode, we talk to the creative people behind the movies that make us scream in terror and delight. From The Best Boy to The Final Girl, these are the people who bring our nightmares to life. On tonight's episode, we're talking to writer-director Jim Towns about his unusual oeuvre of genre films. From confined horror films of women in lockdown to martial arts shows funded by Wu-Tang Collection and expressionistic films shot in abandoned lunatic asylums, Jim Towns has an IMDb that reads like no other. So let's find out how he did it and what it's like to be a writer, director, producer, and storyboard artist all rolled into one.
Welcome to the show, Jim Towns, writer, director, artist, spokesmodel.
Yeah, I'm working on that one. Get there.
Well, Jim, in the indie world, some people might know you from Prometheus Triumphant, House of Bad, State of Desolation, and may have heard of your upcoming martial arts Project X, titled Top Secret.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So what set you on this path? I mean, there's so many ways to end up in indie film land. How did you get here?
It was a circuitous route for me. I grew up loving like monsters and makeup and everything. And I grew up in the primo 80s generation where I saw, you know, Empire Strikes Back and Raiders of the Lost Ark and E.T. and Goonies and all those in the theater. You know, that was the movies were part of a DNA. I mean, they're part of every generation, obviously, but that pocket moment in the 80s, you know, I think every youngster got like inoculated with the magic movies, not the gritty part or the artistic part necessarily always and stuff, but the magic of them was very potent. The Muppets were on, you know, all the Sesame Street, the, you know, everything, that all those things I think were big contributors to just sparking creative imagination in me and in a lot of my friends that I went to school with that have gone on into some kind of creative pursuit. I did always tend towards monsters for some reason. If you see right behind me, you'll see the famous Disney Spooky Sounds of the Haunted House LP, which I had as a kid. I lost it. I had to rebuy it at great expense now. And my mom got me she went to a church flea market. I was like, I don't know, 9 or 8. And she got me a book about makeup for monsters. It's the famous one written by the guy who directed Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. I'm blanking on his name. Monster Movie Makeup, I think it's called. And you see it all the time. People post it. And I think it started a lot of careers. And then my uncle, Jimmy McGiffin, was he'd worked on stage and he'd done theatrical makeup. And he put together a little makeup kit for me one time and brought it over. And I started doing Wolfman makeups and, you know, Jekyll and Hyde stuff. And I started reading about, because, you know, makeup is, you know, as we called it, you know, makeup's a gag. Makeup's something you have to get away. Special effects makeup is something you have to get away with. It's not, it's about performance and it's about character and it's about technique, obviously, but it's really a trick. We're trying to sell you on the idea that someone's a zombie or someone's a monster or someone is changing into something else or whatever you want to have say about it. And this monster movie makeup book, for a kid, it's a book aimed at children, but it really went into the idea of how filmmaking techniques help the makeup. It goes into the Frederick March Jekyll and Hyde, where they changed the color of the lights and used different color makeups to affect a lot of the change that he goes through. So again, I go back to like the magic of it, the secrets. And then that's a big part of it. It's like learning the secrets of techniques. It was something I always dug. I made movies with my friends. We were right at that point where VHS became a thing. So we could do home movies a lot. We did some Super 8 and then we did some home movies on VHS. And then we went back into filmmaking, real film, when my friends started going and taking classes in school. But I was always the artist. I was the guy doing the drawing. So if, you know, someone else would write something, I would illustrate it. If someone else had an idea, I would like sort of develop in and the concepts and stuff. And I kind of went to start, I felt like that was more my strength at the time. And I went that direction in high school. And then into college, I went to the Savannah College of Art and Design. And I majored in painting and then illustration and then sequential art, which is a new major at the time under Bob Pendarvis and Mark Neese. And Scott Hampton and some other great professors I had there. And I went into comic book art and illustration, and I started working in that, doing some of my own independent publishing, hopefully. And then doing some work after school. I lived in Philadelphia and New York for a couple of years, and I did some illustration work. I did a little bit of comic work. I worked on the Matrix website when the Matrix first came out. Oh. Yeah, I had some art there. And that was sort of the... How do I say it? That was the apex of my visual art career as a comic book artist. After that, I had setbacks and some things went sour, and Marvel declared bankruptcy right around then. It was 1998, 99, something like that. The comic standards took a hit. I wasn't doing very well, and I moved back to Pittsburgh, and where I'm from, in about 1999. And I kind of reevaluated what I was doing. I was still painting. I was doing gallery shows. I was doing a lot of work like that. And then my friend Mike McCown, who I'd started making, you know, childhood movies with, he was just getting into, he was working professionally in video. And then he had just sort of gotten into digital video, nonlinear editing systems, you know, the early versions of Premiere and stuff. And then also like After Effects and the ability. So I was starting to look at instead of just that plasticky feel of video that, you know, we grew up with, I was starting to look at this and like we can manipulate this. We can add grain and texture. We can add damage. We can use all these other filters we could do. So he and I, right around 2001 or two, did a short film called Sleep of Reason, which is up on YouTube all over the place. The Sleep of Reason. Just a really short thing. We shot in one night kind of and did a little pickup and stuff and made it really look like an old fashioned silent film. We took digital video and just grained it the heck up and got to mess with the colors. I actually did the music for it. I acted in it. You know, we just, you know, as a little, just a test balloon, I guess, of what were we capable of. And that did well, and that won awards. We won the Creature Award and for the Pittsburgh Film Workers Association, I should say, in 2003, which is it's a giant gold creature from the Black Lagoon statue. Look, that looks like the Oscar, except it's a creature. It's the greatest. It's my favorite thing I own in my house. There's, you know, if the house is on fire, I'm grabbing my cats and the statue and getting the F out. So that was encouraging. We followed that up with a movie called Prometheus Triumphant after a few false starts, I should say, with some other projects as happens. We did a feature length film called Prometheus Triumphant, which is a black and white silent German expressionist style film. And the full title is Prometheus Triumphant, A Fugue in the Key of Flesh. So there's really not a bit marketable with that entire project. There's not one mark. It's also like it's got like frontal nudity in it. It's there's nothing marketable about the entire film. It was an artistic.
It's like anti Michael Bay.
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah. As far, but I was, you know, at that time I was watching a lot of really experimental work. And really grooving with it. I was watching Brothers Quay animation. I was watching Jan Svankmajer. I was watching Elias Merhage's Begotten. A lot of stuff like that. What's the Canadian guy? Guy Madden. Yeah.
Guy Madden, I knew was going to be in there.
Yeah, I was watching a lot of that, and I was kind of like, that was sort of where I was going. I was watching a lot of great music videos. They were really pushing that kind of boundary. We shot Prometheus for like 2 years off and on. We shot in abandoned lunatic asylums, abandoned steel mills, abandoned houses, any place we could find around Pittsburgh. And there's a lot of abandoned crap in Pittsburgh that you can, you know, if you're brave enough, and if you grease a few palms, you can do it. Yeah, we shot at Dixmont Lunatic Asylum, Dixmont State Hospital, I guess I think was the proper title.
Now, wait, I've got to stop you here and ask you, did you use Jenny's for that, for the power? The power has to have been...
We did. We had a generator for the power at Dixmont. Yeah, we rented.
So, I mean, if you're in a essentially haunted building, I assume at night, was this at night?
We weren't allowed to be there at night. It was, you know, because we worked with the owners. We had permission to be there most of the time.
I'm just going to say, if I was shooting that and it was night and the Jenny died, as Jenny's will.
Oh, yeah.
I would have plutzed.
Yeah, it was an incredibly not safe environment. It had been closed in 19. It had been opened in 1888. It was closed in 1988. And this is 2003 or four. We're filming. So it's been closed for 15 years and it had started collapsing in on itself at that point. And so parts of the roof were on the floor with giant nails and spikes everywhere. So parts of the floor were definitely not safe. And I, again, played the main character, and I have a long black cloak and a white mask that he builds himself. And the white mask has the black over the eyes, right? So you can't quite see my eyes and stuff. So my visibility is god awful. And I'm walking, and there's no windows in the place anymore. They're all just open now. So I'm walking past these windows three stories up and I can't see where I'm going. And oh, it's just, but it was a blast, man. We had a good time. We never really, nothing that creepy happened to us. We filmed there for about 4 or 5 days total, I think. There was nothing odd and there was nothing on the video. You know, we were waiting to see anything. But the place did have an overwhelmingly sad vibe that I've written about in some nonfiction stuff. I've written about my experiences. Because you're talking, it's like 100 years of people stuck there. A lot of people that shouldn't have been there, illegitimate children, you know, that like Carnegie's and Fricks would have, they just shove in there. Women who just didn't want to do what society wanted them to do would get stuck in there. So it's a mixture of the sadness of people who are mentally ill and are stuck in a place that, and Dixmont was actually very progressive for its time. Dorothea Dix, not to tangentialize, but Dorothea Dix was a lady who revolutionized mental health care in the United States in the late 1800s. And Dixmont was named after her, as opposed to an almshouse or something where your family had to shove you. This was like a state run place that tried to, you know, make your life comfortable. Anyway. So back to the chronology. So we filmed this, we're about done. And I reach a point where I'm like, you know, my career is not, if I'm going to be serious about this filmmaking, my career is not going to progress the way I wanted to in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I could be a thing there but I need to go somewhere else. This is before the Pittsburgh film industry exploded, by the way. So as soon as I moved to California, like about 4 years later, Pittsburgh becomes, they're filming The Dark Knight there. They're filming Denzel Washington movies there. They're filming, you know, okay. Right. On a crew side, I probably would have been working nonstop had I stayed in Pittsburgh, but instead I moved to California. But I moved out here and it was good. Cause I did, I met a distributor who would put out Prometheus and he put out our next film Stiff after that, which was actually in color and had dialogue and all the things that a movie's now, you know, modern movie's supposed to have. Prometheus generated a little bit of good publicity. I think if you're someone who's going to get it, if you're someone who knows the antecedents, you know, if you're someone who's watched Nosferatu and Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and the Phantom of the Opera and Vampire and those films, you're going to watch that and be like, oh, okay, you know, that's what they're going for. Whether or not we quite got there or not, okay, but we get it.
That's your niche.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was fun doing that because that was a celebration of everything that I had influenced me coming up. But then I was out here. I worked on crews for a couple of years. I did the Reba McEntire show. It was my first set, you know, real professional studio set. I got to be a part of, and I got to work with great people, just amazing behind the scenes people. And then started slowly sort of forging my own way into doing my own films, like getting budgets and doing my own stuff. And then that led to, you know, a few stalled projects as usual. And then finally, in about 2011, yeah, 10 years ago, almost right now, about 10 years ago, right now, we were filming House of Bad. And we filmed, you know, we did like a 12-day shoot and we did some pickups, and that came out. And that changed some stuff for me. That was a movie that came out and made a hit and got great reviews all across the board. And, you know, didn't blow the doors off the box office, but it established me at least. And that was.
Right. And let me just say this for people who have not had a chance to see it yet. And is currently on Tubi. The thing about House of Bad is it's a lovely mix. I mean, it's a caper, you know, film. It's a supernatural film. It's a female, you know, relationships.
Yeah.
Kind of
like
thing.
Like a three-parter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. With the following the Roger Corman rules. So there is some tops coming off, stuff like that. So you got the whole Megillah there. When that script was written, was that the plan? Like, we're going to 4 or 5 quadrant the hell out of this, or how did it turn out the way it did?
I wrote it and okay. So here's what happened. Right after Prometheus comes out and is distributed, I go to my distributor with this idea. And I was like, I want to do this movie about these 3 women in a house and they've stolen a suitcase full of drugs and they have to hide out there and the place is haunted. And I want to do it like a black box theater play where all the sets are almost. And then what's his name did this a few years after this.
In Scandinavia. Yeah. Lars von Trier.
Lars von Trier did this with that one.
Stole film. Your idea.
You know,
a little you know, more close than his.
If I have an idea that I think is good, there's probably 35 other people out there that have had the exact same idea. There's just a zeitgeist. You can't. Yes,
but this is was stolen by a Nazi. So that's extra points.
There's that. Right. Damn Nazis. So I want to do it, but I was like, I want to do it as a black box theater play. All the girls are painted white, almost like Kabuki style. Right. And he's like, yeah, let's not do that. No. Yeah. He's like, or it was really like, let's see how Prometheus does. And Prometheus, I mean, it's made its money back at this point, but it took a bit. And it took me kind of becoming a little bit better known in the indie scene before people were going back and revisiting it. We actually just got the rights back to it now. It's currently not available as far as it shouldn't be available actually. Anyway, you can probably still find the DVDs on Amazon. They're probably still available.
Meanwhile, in Thailand, it's playing a drive-in now.
For sure. And they're probably really confused in Thailand. If it doesn't make sense to most Americans, holy crap. Right? I don't understand this. This is what everybody's like in America. So the House of Bad. So it goes away for a few years. And I do a few other projects and then I meet up with, I've been working on a few things with a buddy of mine named Scott Frizzell, and he's a brilliant set designer and craftsman of his own, a prop builder. He's a really great writer and just all around great guy. And I'm talking about this. Well, I had this idea a little while ago. And I'm working on a pilot at Warner Brothers. I'm like an office PA. I'm just like a, you know, the drone guy delivering scripts and, you know, riding the golf cart around the lot, which is, it's great being on the Warner Brothers lot. I won't complain about that, but the project itself, the show was dumb and terrible. I won't name it by name, but it was just, it's not even on IMDb. You won't be able to find it in my listing. They didn't even like list it. And it was written by, I think it was just an excuse for everyone to make a couple dollars. Like they got this dude, these guys had a development deal and the studio was like, I don't know, make something. And they're like, we'll make this pilot and no one will ever see it. Except Gerald McCraney was in it. And I got to meet Gerald McCraney I got to talk to him for like 2 minutes, which was awesome. Cause I was a big Simon and Simon fan growing up. My mom was too. My mom's a big Simon. So she liked the Gerald McCraney. even then, Anyway, so I'm working on this project, and part of it is like you end up having tons of downtime. You're just sitting in the production office for hours and hours and hours. I'm like, okay, I'm going to bring my laptop. I'm going to start cranking this thing out. And I started talking with my friend Scott about it. I was like, maybe if we just got, this was like really right at that moment where everyone was trying to figure out how to film everything. The bottom had kind of dropped out of home video distribution, and it was harder to make money, and no one had quite figured out streaming yet. And so everyone was like, what if we just figure out how to shoot everything in one location? So you have all those movies. You have like 35,000 movies that are, just take place in one. Everyone wakes up in one room and they have to find a way out. And everyone, which is, I think, what led to the escape room craze, I think, because they made so many damn movies of this so that you could didn't have to pay for the location as much. Anyway, so that idea came up to me, and I was like, okay, well, this all takes place in one house. They're hiding out. They can't physically leave the house because, you know, everyone's looking for them. So I was like, maybe that works out. And we kind of put the project together. We got a little bit of scratch together. My friend, Liz, Castro, who is a special effects coordinator. She's an Emmy winning coordinator on the Star Trek shows and Lost and all these other shows. She was going away for a couple of weeks, and she was like, you can use my house in Pasadena. You just have to, like, you know, watch my dog and like Charlie. So it worked out. We, you know, with the house is supposed to be set up in the mountains. So when we got shots of the house, we had to digitally remove the houses on either side and make it look more isolated. But except for that,
I have to say, this is the most indie thing I've heard today, that you traded the location for dog sitting.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, so that's how that came to be. We did that in 8 days and then a few pickup days. And that's how that was the first time I worked with Sadie Katz. She came in to audition and was she came in after, like, I think she'd worked like 4 days straight with barely sleeping on another film, and then came to the audition just fried out of her mind.
And walked into principal photography in 8 days. How indie was that?
I mean, I had an AD and a second AD, and I had a camera and a you know, AC and a grip and stuff. So it's I've done things since that are more indie than that, actually. We didn't have a permit for the house, or any of the exteriors. We did some stuff up in the woods in Angeles National Forest and stuff.
Why'd you go for the two ADs as opposed to more grips?
I don't know. I just, I should say my producer Scott was sort of a line producer as well. And then I had a second AD. So it's sort of one and a half. And he wore a couple of different hats and stuff, but yeah, I mean, we had an armorer on it, a buddy of mine and stuff. I mean, I just pulled, nobody got paid hardly at all. You know, they got a small day wage. And it was just a lot of favors. But sure. But yeah, no, that worked out. Hasn't worked out that well since. Now everyone's like, nope, got a day rate. Sorry.
I am like that on Crew Stories and movie set memes. I'm on there. I understand that those guys, for the most part, they're, you know, they're roustabouts. You know, I understand that, but man, when they start like raging about, like, you never take less than your day rate. Fuck people in their dream projects. And I'm like,
yeah,
I don't know how you think these movies get made below a certain, do you think people just pop out at the, you know, studio level?
No. Right. Yeah. I mean, and I'm actually, so the Immortal Hands, just a light day on Immortal Hands is like $2,600 minimum. There's no possible way. And that's if we're just not even paying for a location or anything. That's just like it. And it's a smallish crew, but that's just everyone's rate and everyone, you know, getting paid. The average day is probably about $6,000 to $7,000 or $8,000 on that show. The next thing I want to do, if nothing really big pops, I'm going to do another two hander kind of thing with starring Sadie Katz and another actress. And I'm going to film it myself. I'm going to just do the whole, I just want to go back and do like a little movie, you know, and we'll still like have to hurry and, you know, and I'll pay them and everything like that. But it's like, if I just pull that off and stuff, it'd be fun to just go back to that, the rudiments of it, you know? Because it's stressful. Like, you know, you're when you're not getting the day and it's costing that much money, you're like, oh God, I'm really screwing someone now.
Well, and the thing is that, like, you know, Angie and I talk, you know, frequently about going out to LA where there's actual, you know, people who do work.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, when you talk about doing permits, like, I'm like, what is this permit of which you speak?
Oh, and it is the biggest racket in the world out here. It's so you know, Los Angeles County, basically brokered with a company called LA Film LA. So there's a private company that is the only place you can go for a permit. It's a private organization. They're not public. They're not required to do anything really. So they get to charge what they want. They get to tell you what you want. I produced a film for a kid up in the desert. We're in the middle of the desert and there's like eight people. And they're like, you need a fire marshal. We're like, why do we have eight people there? Well, there's a desert. I was like, yeah, but we're not lighting anything on fire. Like, no, you need a fire marshal. It's a racket to get retired firefighters work. And you have to pay them like $500 a day for this. Sorry, this fucker to just stand the fuck around and like not do shit. And eat your food. That's all this asshole does. And I'm like, this is such bullshit. It's
the only time I've come anywhere close to that. I'm going to try not to burst into tears while I tell you okay. this. When we were doing our feature that we're in post on right now, everyone told us the key to selling this for money is you need somebody with a name recognition. It doesn't matter what supporting role on what sitcom, somebody that's known. Right. And while we were digging around, you know, doing our casting, there was one part, it's one scene, one person playing a creepy teacher. Okay, that's it. And somebody said, oh, you know who lives in Flagstaff and that we know? I was like, who? So it was the female lead from Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, Kira Schoen?
No, the other one, the first.
Oh, really? Oh, the blonde lady. Oh, Judith, whatever.
Judy.
Yeah,
Judy. So she still does theater up there. And she is a lovely lady. She's just like a lady who does some community theater.
That's so cool.
I reached out to her and she says, I will do your movie.
Oh, my God.
I will do it at scale. I said, Judy, this is making this movie. Thank you so much.
But
Judy is SAG, which means you got to talk to those guys. And when we talked to them, we were green as grass.
Yeah.
So we couldn't go in there and talk to them like, yeah, well, what if we do this with a Lubinsky double twist half day
knock? No, right. Yeah.
We were just like, we want to make the movie with the SAG lady.
Yeah.
And they hit us with all that shit you're talking about. They were like, oh, we see here in the script that there is a dog. We're like, yeah, but it's not in her scene. They're like, doesn't matter. If it's a SAG picture. It's a SAG picture. You need to hire somebody from, you
know, ASPCA.
And I'm like, okay. And they're like, but it has to be from our list. I'm like, wait, are you saying I have to pay someone to come out from LA to sit there and watch us not hurt a dog? And they were like, absolutely.
Yeah.
And in the end, I had to call Judy and go, Judy, I am so sorry. I can't afford you.
Yeah.
And she said, Drew, I've had this conversation before. God bless you. Knowing what I know now, which is not a hell of a lot more, but what I know now, I know the shit that could have been done.
Yeah. Yeah. You could have just brought her on, done it, and then apologized afterwards.
Any number of things. Right.
Yeah.
But man, when I hear folks talking from LA, I'm just like, on the one hand, you can walk out the door, throw a rock and hit a gaffer. On the other hand.
Yeah. That gaffer's not showing up for less than $250 a day. You know, it's it. Yeah. Yeah. It's a different mentality. And you get this vibe where it's almost there's almost this union vibe of like, it's us against production.
Right.
And I run into that sometimes and it's like, I'm not the enemy here, man. I'm paying you and we're doing this.
So I wanted to ask you on House of Bad, you shoot 8 days principal photography, 2 days pickup, 10 days yeah. total. You got a feature film. Yes. Now, there's some indie filmmakers or wannabe indie filmmakers listening to this and their nose just started bleeding. Can you explain how you achieved the rapidity of that shoot?
Yeah. Well, obviously, if you have a 90-page script, we didn't have quite a 90-page script. I don't know. I think we had like an 82-page script or something. But say you have a 90-page script and you shoot for 9 days, you need to do 10 pages a day. That's just the math. You need to at least average 10 pages a day. The way I've come up, and I've come up pretty indie, where I've learned my own way of doing things to a lot of ways. I know the established methodology of doing things, and either that hasn't worked for me, or I figured out a way that works better for me before I found that out and have stuck with that. The advice I would give anybody tackling something that daunting, that kind of a schedule, is just you need to walk onto set as insanely overprepared as you possibly can be. You need to have done almost all your creative thinking and planning ahead of time, because you're not going to have time to do it on set. And you need to be really prepared, because inevitably everything's going to go wrong on any given day. And you need to, but if you have a plan in place, then you can just adjust. So, if anyone's listening to this, they're not going to be able to see this, but I during our little hiatus, I found my storyboards for the film. And so this is where kind of having the art background comes in handy. I don't do sheets. I do index cards, and I do very insanely detailed storyboards. More than is required really for a storyboard, but because I'm doing it, what I get to do is not only draw where the characters are and the framing and the lighting, hopefully a little bit, the mood I want to create, but I also get to kind of like, get the expressions I want almost in the characters. And again, I have an advantage being a visual based artist ahead of time. Everything from boots walking to, whatever, expressions, reactions, coverage. I plot it out that way because then I have like a visual outline of how I'm going to shoot, and I know my shots. And inevitably, when I'm on set and I'm thinking about 45,000 different things, being a director is about, to me, it's about the macro and the micro. You have to be able to focus on how, again, an actor is lifting their coffee cup and drinking it and making sure that is right for the character and the way they would do it or whatever. But you also have to understand how that moment of them drinking coffee works within the entire context of the 90-minute film. So it's the minute and the cosmic at the same time. So you're thinking about all this stuff. The one thing then when I'm on set and I have the storyboards, I don't have to think about is like, did I get my coverage? Because if I can look at my storyboards, every time we get a shot, I pull the storyboard around. I usually keep them on a metal ring. I flip them over. And when I flipped them over, every storyboard that I have for the scene, I know I've covered the scene. I know I've got all my angles. I've got inserts. I've got whatever I need. And I'm not leaving myself owing anything. And that's what kills you, is like realizing like, oh, I got to go back and get that one shot where they it's got to connect those two things, or if it doesn't make sense and now I'm in trouble. And that's also how I think I managed to achieve a certain, dare I say, cinematic professional quality in my films beyond the budget that a lot of them, are made with. You see a lot of films and it just ends up being a shot with two people standing there talking to each other. And it gets on the very indie side, and it gets very Ed Wood very quickly, which I'm a big fan of Ed Wood, but it doesn't help you when you're trying to sell this as a thing, because the whole point of it is the lie of it is to take, $50,000 and make it look like you spent $200,000 on it. That's the goal. I mean, and that's how you if you make a movie that looks like it costs four times what you made it for, your chances of selling it for something approaching that are dramatically increased. Therefore, there's your profit to, keep yourself going, and then also hopefully do the next project. That's the goal.
So anyone who's done filmmaking knows that in a fast shoot, what eats up your time is your setups. You know, your individual set camera on sticks, here you go. A lot of indie filmmakers try to get around that by using handheld, or if they can afford it, you know, easy rig, fake Steadicam stuff.
Yeah.
But I didn't get that vibe off yours. Were you on sticks, or how were you doing that?
House of Bad was, and again, what did help us was we were mostly one location for House of Bad. So that did help. I know for a fact we were on sticks for some of it. I remember a tripod on set. But we did do a lot. Chad Courtney, my cinematographer, who's I don't want to say I discovered Chad Courtney, but he'd done a few little things. And he'd been in AC a little bit, and someone recommended him to me. And I saw this little thing he shot. I was like, whoa, this kid is really, really good. And then he did my thing. And then he went up and ended up working for Microsoft. He shot tons of commercials for Microsoft. And hopefully I'm going to be able to lure him back to shoot something with me again someday. he's a great guy. We're both Star Wars nerds. And I really enjoy working with him. He did a lot of handheld, and then we did a lot of sandbag stuff. You know, if anyone doesn't know, like you can kind of mix the two things by if you just get you get a big sandbag and you put the camera on it and you work on from that and you get just that little bit of agitation, from the camera. But it doesn't have the full on like NYPD blue, you know,
right.
You know,
did you actually mount it on a softball or did you put it flush on the sandbag?
I can't remember. I think we almost did kind of everything. my favorite bit in House of Bad is, and if you've seen it and you go back and watch it now, maybe this will change your experience. I don't know. The lighting was a challenge. We did mostly Kinos. We did some Airy lights. And the challenge in a room is that if you turn around, you know, wherever you go, you end up seeing light stands everywhere where they're hanging. So all throughout the house, you're going to see, if you watch House of Bad, you'll see like in the bathroom, especially is a great thing. All these towels are hanging like on a rack, right? By the one thing. That's actually the light stand. And we clipped all the towels to the light stand and wrapped them around like a bathrobe and a couple towels and stuff. The light stand's in the shot. You just can't see it because it's, you know, we did that in the living room too. And stuff like that. It was funny. And anyone who works with me will tell you, I'm a huge fan of if I can figure out a dumb solution to something, like the dumber the better, and get away with it. I'm so outrageously happy with that. If I can, again, I'll induce his name. If I can Ed Wood something and get away with it, I will always do that and stuff like that. Cause I just like, again, it's the trick. I go back to that, the thing with the lighting and stuff like that. It's the trick. Like just do the trick. I love in camera effects. If I can figure out some weird way to, there's a shot in House of Bad. Maybe you remember, Andrew, where, the youngest daughter is possessed by the ghost of the mother and she's looking in the mirror. First of all, one of our best special effects was my friend, Lisa Marie, Costabile, who was, I think she was 6 months, 5 or 6 months pregnant when we shot. And then like 8 months and 3 weeks pregnant and 5 days pregnant when we did the pickups. And it was terrifying, by the way. We had someone ready with keys in a car at any moment because she had like almost a fight scene. It was the craziest thing. We did a flashback where her and the dad are fighting. The daughter, the young girl is looking in the mirror and the she's seeing her mother's reflection in the mirror is her. And it's the dumbest thing. When we filmed it, we're angled on the mirror and our actress, Berkeley, and Lisa Marie are literally standing right next to each other. And Lisa Marie's just framed out, but the angle is you're looking past Berkeley or Cheryl. She goes by both names professionally. You look right past Cheryl and but the angle of the mirror, you're seeing Lisa Marie. It's dumb. It's silent movie stuff, you know, but.
Yeah, but that's I agree with you. I love a good cheat the shot.
Yeah.
That uses it because it feels like a magician, a trick. This brings us, Jim, to Andrew's five big questions. Longtime listeners know the five big questions is five seemingly innocent sounding questions that when answered right off the top of your head will lay bare your soul and let the listening audience know, hey, do we go over there on Tubi and check out that film or do we pass it up and go to Disney?
We avoid this man and his creations at all costs.
So this will tell. This will tell.
All right.
Here we go. Question number one. What is your most treasured possession other than your Pittsburgh award?
You know, I own a lot of stuff. That's really hard.
I'm waiting for your wife to stick her head up over the drapes and like be like,
if I call her a possession, then probably not.
Oh no, maybe not.
I have, you can't see, it's behind me right to the right of this Frankenstein painting I did. It's a 1912 edition of the works of Edgar Allan Poe. And it's got illustrations by Harry Clark, who was like a Mooka-esque illustrator I really like. And a buddy of mine just gave it to me. He couldn't keep it anymore. It's water damaged and stuff. It is not in great shape. But it's one of those things. I would say that, and honestly, that monster-making book for kids that my mom got me. This one's really cool, but I would honestly say maybe that monster making book that I mentioned before that my mom, because my mom got it for me and she's not with us anymore. And maybe that was like the spark that got me moving and stuff like that. That'd be up there. My 75 Nova's up there too. I got to admit that's a big, I got that a couple of years ago and that's special to me too.
All right. Question number two, where would you most like to live in terms of place, and I'll give you time too.
You're not picking the time. I get to pick the time.
You get to pick. It could be contemporary, okay, but it could also be in the past.
I would stick with contemporary. I really appreciate modern medicine and the things that come along with it. I appreciate, you know, FedEx and being able to order things and deliver them. I would stick with contemporary, but I'm leaning towards Scotland. I just did 23andMe, and we knew our family was from Wales and England, but it turns out I've got a lot of Scot in me. And I think maybe a little somewhere in the middle of nowhere up there in Northern Scotland would be really, I could do that.
All right.
Good wish you too.
Yeah. Yeah. Question number three, what movie character in all of cinema do you most identify with?
Toshirô Mifune's character Kikuchiyo in Seven Samurai.
Wow.
I never don't feel like I'm just faking it.
True.
Like he is. Cause he's the peasant farmer who's pretending he's a samurai, you know?
Yeah.
But he also attacks things with absolute energy and gusto. And that's what I try to do too. Yeah.
And inside of you, there's an inner 12-year-old that you're pretending to be. Mm-hmm. Very, very nice.
Yeah. I'm just trying to be someone that when I was 12, I would have thought was a cool dude. Right. I mean, isn't that just a good goal to do? Be someone you would have appreciated when you were a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Question number four, what word or phrase drives you crazy? If you had the ability to ban it, you would do it.
I would, with leaving out the one word that could be anything, it would be, well, I'm not a blank, but. So it's like, you know, well, I'm not a filmmaker, but get ready. Here it comes.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we could even take it to, well, I'm not racist, but. Because you know whatever's coming after that is just going to be...
Technically, right? It will be racist.
Yeah, exactly. It's the caveat people make before they give you an uninformed opinion. And uninformed opinions are possibly my least favorite thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, bonus question. What to you is a perfect breakfast?
Perfect breakfast. I think you and I have discussed this online. I make these things called bats in the morning, and it's a bacon and avocado toast. It's just, there's nothing complicated about it. It's bacon, it's avocado. And
you smear the avocado or leave it intact?
I sometimes smear it and I sometimes slice it too.
Keep
a little bit of salt and pepper. Yeah. You know,
That would be good. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I've been out here. I moved out in 2004. five. So it's six, going on 16 years now in California. And I always think of myself as a Pennsylvania guy, as a Pittsburgh guy in California, right? And then I go back to Pittsburgh and I realize how California I really am. And that avocado thing just gave me away like crazy. I'll tell you that. Cause I never even liked guacamole in Pittsburgh. And then I come out here, I'm like, man, guacamole is really good. And it's just cause avocados are way better. So yeah, it's funny. I find out I'm made to understand how California I've gone. And my wife is born and bred California. And I think a lot of her is rubbed off on me for good.
All right. Second bonus question.
Okay.
If you could come back after dying for only 24 hours, what would you do?
No, man, I'm going to give you just the sappy answer. I think I just spend a day hanging with my wife and petting my cats and stuff. Cause you know, they're, you know, this is our little family here. And I haven't always had that in my life. I've been, you know, on my own a lot as an adult, and I just got lucky, and I happened to meet the right person, and we happened to find the right place in the world together. And we never adopted these. Our two cats just showed up one after the other one day and just were like, hey, you're our people now. And here we go. And now we have this, now we have a tortoise as well. So our neighbor is moving up north where he can't live. So we just inherited Charlie a tortoise. So our family's growing. Right. But I appreciate that. Again, like I said, I haven't always had it, and now I do. I really do. I'm really grateful that I've got my people and my creators.
All right.
So what's the matter? I mean, we love being creative. We love doing what we do and everything like that. But at the end of the time, the end of the day, you have to have a life too. And that's important. If you don't have that balance, everything else kind of goes wonky. So
yeah, the famous thing. Okay. Question number five.
Yep.
Ireland, funny or not funny?
Ireland?
Yes.
Funny. Ireland's funny. The everybody I know there is a crack up. No, and a part of my family's
crack up.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
Yeah. 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 No, funny. Beautiful. Well, I want to go someday too.
Very cool. Alrighty. Well, we've been talking with Jim Towns, filmmaker of writing, directing fame, and still plugging away with that new one. I'm really digging that Project X. I can't wait to hear the real title.
Well, you got a little sneak preview, so I'm glad if you're enthusiastic about it, and I appreciate your opinion, then I think we have something on our hands here.
I think you do.
I cannot wait for it to come out and stuff. So just if you want to follow me I'm on all the socials. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. Just look up Jim Towns. I'm basic on all those things. There's regular updates on everything we've talked about, including the house and the tortoise and everything. So yeah, in the car.
Far from basic, but a hell of a guy, Jim Towns.
That was my interview with writer-director Jim Towns. Subscribe to This Bloody Business and join me as we go behind the scenes for more tantalizing tales of horror filmmaking. Until next time, I'm Andrew Johnson Schmidt, and that's a wrap.